I don't know about you, but I left it all on the den floor last night. It was a rough game. To the 78% that said it was going to be a nail-biter, you did not have any idea how much of a nail-biter it truly would be. It was an incredible game, even though an ugly game. I don't know about you, the 9 penalties that they said we had felt like 19, or maybe sometimes during the game like 90. But nonetheless, the Saints come out victorious, winning a game against the Carolina Panthers, and now had the best record in the NFC. And, you know, in all of I think the best record in all of NFL football, as I recall. So I don't want to take anything away from them. Big game this weekend, Pittsburgh Steelers. Loved watching the game. And we're going to talk about them in the second hour, Mike Dettillier, NFL analyst. In the third hour, we're going to be talking to Kristen Palmer, city council member, about some proposed changes for short-term rentals, Airbnb, VRBO, and others, the impact that they're having on some of the neighborhoods in and around the city of New Orleans, and what they're going to propose as it relates to these changes and why. And in this hour, a number of states, as a result of any number of studies that have been released, NABO, the National Association of State Budget Officers, has released a report and talks about a number of states that have had revenue forecasts that have exceeded what their forecasts were from the previous year. And that's a good thing. And they've been able to do some stuff with this money. And we're going to talk to Adam Michel, policy analyst, Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Adam, if you could explain for our listening audience exactly what this tax cut bill and what its peripheral effects were, especially, first of all, in a positive matter, and whether or not there's been any negative side to them.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to see this report is coming out right now. When the tax law passed, it did a whole lot of things. It lowered tax rates. It increased the child tax credit. And one of the big effects that a lot of people were saying was going to have a negative effect on the states, capping the state and local tax deduction, which subsidizes high tax states at the expense of lower tax states. All of the states were crying foul, saying this is going to hurt our revenue. There's no way we're going to be able to make our budgets this year. And lo and behold, the report that you referenced is showing that average tax collection across the states is up by almost 8%, that revenue outperformed forecasted revenue growth by over 3.5%. And so what this tells us is that the stronger economy, people buying more through the sales tax revenue, people having more jobs, people's incomes starting to grow faster than we've seen since we were climbing out of the depths of the Great Recession, all of those things are contributing to more revenue for states, and we're seeing it in the numbers.
And there are still a number of state and local entities that are on a different fiscal year than others that still haven't been able to report the benefits as it relates to their revenue forecast either, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the good news will only continue to roll in. I mean, a lot of these numbers don't incorporate all the spending that's going on right now as people are buying Christmas gifts and that whole piece of the economy. So I expect that sales tax revenue will only continue to increase. And as I alluded to, the economy is still doing well, and each sort of release we get from the federal government shows that not only are people getting new jobs and more jobs, but wage growth is increasing finally faster than it has in quite some time. And what that means is people's incomes are larger, and it means that ultimately more revenue is going to the states and the federal government.
You know, it's interesting is some of the states have had difficulty in this state. For example, Adam, we have a revenue estimating conference, and that conference has said that our revenues are going up, but yet we're not making the budgetary adjustments in order to reflect same. So some of the reported data, as you just pointed out, is going to be understated in many ways.
Yeah, I think that points out a really a crucial problem that governments at both the state and here in Washington really struggle with, and people don't fully understand. When you see that there's a budget shortfall or a deficit or adding money to the debt, that doesn't necessarily mean that tax revenue is too low or that we're not taxing enough. It almost always means that the politicians are spending more than they should. And they'll often try to sell that to you as, oh, we need to raise the gas tax or we need to raise income taxes just a little bit to pay for the shortfall. But it ultimately comes down to them spending way more than they're bringing in, even as revenue continues to increase. So we need to make sure we're looking at both sides of the equation, how much is going out the door and how much is coming in the door.
And in some states, they've actually reacted to the positive revenue numbers that are coming in by actually cutting state income taxes. That is a direct reflection of the realignment of the tax rates and what happens with the state income taxes that give credit for SALT, as you were talking about before, in a positive way. And they've cut the taxes in order to reflect that it would stay revenue neutral for that state.
Yeah, these are the responsible states, I'd like to call them. The tax law also, it when it increased the child tax credit, it also took away the personal and dependent exemptions. They sort of changed how the tax code worked in that way. And what that meant for a lot of states is that the tax base, the things they were taxing, actually increased. And so without also lowering the tax rates like they did at the federal level, then a lot of states are going to see additional revenue for that reason as well. And so that's something that folks at the local level, depending on how your state is structured, need to make sure they stay on top of your state capitals to take these revenue changes into account and make sure the state isn't getting a windfall in revenue from either a larger economy or changes at the federal level, and then returning that money back to people through lower taxes rather than incorporating it into ever larger and growing government.
Adam, we got to get to a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about how a number of states are moving this money over to the Rainy Day Savings Fund and what that ultimately means to the taxpayers in each one of those individual states. Can you stay with us?
Yeah, definitely.
All righty. We're with Adam Michel, policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. We're back. We're talking to Adam Michel, policy analyst, Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. One of the other byproducts, Adam, has been that a number of states have decided to put money in their rainy day savings fund. And in order to take interest income out of that, in order to transfer to unfunded accrued liability costs for their pension systems, otherwise known as their legacy cost. And in California, for example, they're budgeting $1 billion for wildfire response and cleanup.
Yeah, we're talking about all this additional revenue that states are seeing this year, and so one of the things that they're doing with it is boosting their rainy day funds. I think it's something like 31 states are boosting those balances in fiscal year 2018, and that's if you're not going to return the additional revenue back to the people, boosting those funds is the next best thing you can do with it. It makes sure that you don't have to raise taxes when there are disasters. A lot of states pulled on their rainy day funds during the Great Recession, and it's something that the federal government doesn't do. I don't know how closely your listeners follow what's going on in Washington right now, but a big part of the spending debate is how much money are we going to spend on wildfire cleanup, on helping people from the hurricanes and earthquakes, and all of these things should be budgeted. I mean, yes, they are emergencies, but no, they aren't necessarily unforeseen. They happen every year, and both states and the federal government should budget for those things when we need the money for those unforeseen big catastrophes.
Another category that a lot of states are considering, and in fact, Louisiana is one of them, is that they're not up to the Southern regional average as it relates to compensation for teachers and some other expenditures in the educational field. And it looks as though a lot of states are doing this as well, as much as $11 billion across this country in taking some of this increased revenue and assigning it to those expenses.
Yeah, I think of all of the categories of things that states are putting this additional revenue to, education tops the list, and they're increasing funding for education more than they did in previous years, and so it seems to be a priority for states across the board, and it's behind education and healthcare expenditures, these are some of the biggest pieces of state budgets, and so we're seeing them increase spending in those areas.
And also, I think a number of states have been able to leverage these payments associated with grant opportunities with the federal government. I know Betsy DeVos has talked about that in the past, and it's created a unique opportunity for them to catch up in many, many categories in trying to improve their educational systems, not only throughout the South, but throughout the country.
Yeah, I think the administration here is focused on returning a lot of that power to the states and helping them make decisions that are best at the local level rather than controlling it from here in Washington. So I think to the extent that more of that power can be pushed to the states and states can decide what type of education is best for their citizens, the better.
And some of the detractors that want to talk about diminishing the impact of the tax cuts, look to the Wayfair decision and saying that really a lot of this is coming about as a result of internet taxation, the South Dakota versus Wayfair case. I heard one of the talking pundits the other day saying that, it really wasn't about Trump. It's more about everybody's got this huge economic boom that's coming about as a result of internet taxation. I was a tax collector prior to coming on radio as a sheriff and worked very hard on internet taxation. And we had already started collecting 3 years ago from in a number of big box stores just voluntarily started collecting. And the impact, in my view, hasn't been as significant as what some of these folks are trying to take away the plus side of the Trump stuff and associate it with internet taxation.
Yeah, I agree. I think the impact of the Supreme Court decision, which allows states to tax a larger portion of e-commerce, is a relatively minor piece of this. The statistic I quoted, almost 8% increase in tax collections, that's actually an increase in income tax collections.
Right.
That 8% increase doesn't even factor in a lot of the sales tax increases in sales tax revenue that we're seeing. And then you're right that the Amazon is something like 50% of e-commerce in the United States, and they were already collecting taxes on all of their inbound shipments to states in all the 50 states. Same thing, Apple is a big online retailer. They were already collecting it. So is Walmart. They sell a lot online. They were already collecting sales tax. So I expect that the internet sales tax expansion will be important for a couple of states, but not a big overwhelming effect like we're seeing across a majority of states here.
It just always mystifies me that folks are trying to find some other reason other than what most economists are saying is driving this. It never ends. We just can't, rejoice in the successes because it might be associated with an individual or with a certain party.
Yeah, I think that we see that time and time again. I mean, economists across the board know that when you tax something less, you get more of it. You can debate about the magnitudes, but that fundamental fact is true, and that's what we're seeing. The government is taxing income less. People are working more. The government is taxing investment less. Businesses are investing more in America, which means more jobs and higher wages. And we're seeing that across every state, and we're seeing it quarter after quarter after quarter. So it's the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, it's almost a year old. Its anniversary is this week, and it's been a tremendous success.
What will be the impact, in your view? April 15th of 2019 is the first time that individuals will be filing under the new tax code. What kind of impact do you think will be experienced then?
Yeah, I think it'll be mixed. For the majority of Americans, tax paying has gotten simpler. The standard deduction was increased, meaning fewer people will itemize their taxes, which reduces complexity. As I mentioned in our last segment, the exemptions for dependents and yourself went away, and that just was transitioned into the child tax credit. So there's a lot of things that are simpler for taxpayers. Unfortunately, there were things that were made more complex. If you're a small business owner, a lot of the international pieces of the tax code for large businesses were made more complicated. So for some people, it may be a larger headache to figure out all the changes. But for your sort of average taxpayer, things will hopefully be simpler. And your employer has already started withholding less money from your paycheck. So you shouldn't expect like a larger tax refund. That should already be reflected in your pay.
But the standard deduction thresholds have gone up to an amount that seems to really overcompensate for many of those that went away in most areas of the country, with the exception of a few really metro cities where their tax rates were over the top.
Yes, the standard deduction was increased more than the value of a lot of the things that were taken away. So that's why one of the reasons why over 90% of Americans will see a tax cut or no change at all when they file their taxes coming up here in a couple of months.
All righty, Adam Michel, policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us. We truly appreciate your insight and have a great holiday season.
Thanks for having me on. You too.
All righty. We want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text us at 870-870. What are your... We're back, and on the text line, the increase is because corporations get a lower deduction because they paid less federal tax. Education becomes a priority during elections when budget cuts have to be made. Education is the first on the list of cuts. Politicians are doing nothing. One of the reasons why I wanted to talk to Adam Michel today was because this very issue just came up with the Revenue Estimating Conference. And when we look towards any number of states, you know, that 19 states are reported unexpectedly higher general fund revenue halfway through fiscal year 2019. And a lot of the states have made these adjustments and have decided to put it towards any number of needs that they have. And obviously in this state, one of the issues was whether or not we would give teachers more money as a result of this. Two members of the Revenue Estimating Conference had voted for that, and one has voted no. It requires unanimity. The two economic forecasters that are supposed to be independent, they have of one another and of the others, have all said that that the revenue enhancements are real, and they can expect those to be true. And as a result thereof, there was a move afoot by the governor and others in order to finance these increases in education. This is a similar tack that has been taken, or strategy that's been taken, by any number of other states. And 40 of the 50 states beat their revenue projections in fiscal 2018, the highest number to do so since 2006. And a total of 19 states are now reporting that revenues are coming in for the next fiscal year higher already. Remember, not all governments are on calendar year fiscal years, so there are many that have different ones. In fact, at the sheriff's office, we were on a fiscal year of July-June because of being the tax collector. And a number of government entities have not been able to reveal exactly what the impacts are for them for the following year either. And we talked about the rainy day savings fund and putting money there, and also a number of states that are putting money into education. In fact, $11 billion in that category. And in the rainy day fund, a lot of folks are trying to catch up on their unfunded accrued liability for legacy costs, which is the pension financing. And taking the tack of more one-time events of being able to make these payments and not relying on it as a recurring expenditure in that respect. And there's just a small number of states that have had to cut spending because the revenue projections haven't come in as high as they needed to be. And I think that's about seven states that are doing so. And the cuts are, having said that, minimal. They're not huge cuts. So anyway, the impact has been thus far very positive. It always remains to be seen because the economic picture and landscape is changing constantly, and keeping up with it. In fact, the market's not doing so well over the past several days. And, you know, so we'll see what impacts that will have. And on a Blue Runner opinion poll, are President Trump's tax cuts responsible for economic growth and higher state revenues? 89% of the respondents say yes. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 260-1870, or text us at 870-870. What are your thoughts? Do you see more in your paycheck? Do you think it's going to have a positive effect come April or before when you file your income tax returns? And what are your expectations? We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and there was an article in The Advocate done by Melinda Deslatte talking about Louisiana Spotlight Governor's plan for teacher pay raise could be spoiled by the House GOP. And it's talking about what I was mentioned before with the Revenue Estimating Conference, that refusing to boost Louisiana's income projection, House Republican leaders threatened to squelch Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards' push to include a public school teacher pay raise. You will recall that the governor said that he was going to give out a $1,000 a year pay raise because we're below the southern average as it relates to pay for teachers. The first meeting that was held was attended by House Appropriations Chairman Cameron Henry, voted against it. There was a subsequent meeting as four members of this panel. And the second time, the Speaker of the House, Taylor Barrock, came, and he rejected the economists who said that tax collections and economic modeling support an increase in the state income forecast for the budget year that ends June 30th and next budget year. Those projections determine, actually, it's a process that's done every year, that determine how much money the lawmakers and the governor can spend. And sometimes these modifications, each year, actually, these modifications require a unanimous vote from the four-member panel. And that's what I was talking about before. I would love to hear from the teachers, and I would love to hear what your reaction is to. And I think the commissioner of administration, as reported in the article, Jay Darden's comments were most appropriate. He said things are better. And some of the things that had been done over the past year and a half have put them in that position. And then they reap the benefit of the tax cut plan as outlined and is implemented by President Trump. And he went on to say, you can't bury your head in the sand and pretend they're not better. Most immediately, refusal to change the forecast stalls a $43 million list of spending priorities, mainly on public safety programs as well as teacher pay raises. And these obviously are critical issues that need to be funded. And, the price tag for this is a sum certain. They're able to deal with that, and the improved tax collection projections that we talked about, both on internet taxation and some of the other things that are coming in, is that the state is going to have about $162 million more in general state tax income next budget year under the existing projections, and they're proposing to spend about $30 million or so less than that number going in order to have that cushion. So, you know, when we talk about having opportunity and sending that to appropriate areas as it relates to expenditures, it just seems to me that we ought to have a more robust conversation about this before we're having these meetings. And what's talked about is that, well, we're just being fiscally conservative. Well, that sounds nice. That's a good sound bite. I mean, but that doesn't get you anywhere unless you look at the critical needs of what's going on and what we obviously need to do in order to keep the recruiting effort strong, especially in public education. There is not a single investment in this state that is going to reap bigger benefits than public education, plain and simple. The numbers are there. The numbers speak for themselves. The states that have made the continued investment in public education more often than not reap the benefits. And that's why when we have out-migration from this state, it's because they move to locations where they can send their kids to public schools. It's so much easier to recruit companies and employees when you have a public school offering that's real, makes sense, and the empirical data supports it, and the outcomes are incredible. I don't know why we keep missing these messages. You tell me. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and got a text asking me about our expert in this field. And Adam Michelle focuses on tax policy and federal budget as a policy analyst at the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies with the Heritage Foundation. He has a master's in economics from George Mason University, which is actually one of the premier universities for economists, and also holds a Bachelor of Arts in Politics from Whitman College. He's an alumnus of the Mercatus Fellowship Program and is currently pursuing his PhD in economics at George Mason University as well. Oftentimes when we reach out to some of the think tanks, both liberal and conservative, they have a laundry list of folks that are incredibly credentialed in their field, and always enjoy talking to these folks because they keep their finger on the pulse of what's happening. Oftentimes we try to get it from both sides, both the liberal think tanks as well as the conservative think tanks. I guess probably because I'm a little bit more conservative leaning, especially fiscally conservative, it's difficult to get the more liberal-minded think tanks on the air with us because they know the perspective that I come from, and it's a shame because I love to debate the topics with everyone, you know, on that. And I think it makes for interesting dialogue. As I said before, and our teaser says, we can agree to disagree. It doesn't mean we're always going to agree. Just want to remind everybody in the third hour, Councilwoman Kristen Palmer is going to be coming in. A lot of controversy around short-term rentals in Airbnb. And there has been some proposed measures that are going to be considered by the council. And she will help explain the mindset that goes behind these proposals. And we'll get a better understanding of exactly what it is that's being proposed. But it looks at the surface that there's going to be things are going to be vastly different than what's occurring now. And I understand both sides of the issue. I get it. It's a slippery slope. It's a balance of interests of the neighborhoods and the overabundance of Airbnb and just having an overabundance of investment properties in your neighborhoods. It's one thing if you're headed to a destination place where you may experience some of that. And I guess the difficulty is when you think about this from a citywide perspective is how do you find a geographic balance, the economic balance, and everything else. And I don't know, how would you like living next door to folks that change every week? You know, a lot of people don't think about it in that respect. They're focused on the money, and sometimes the mindset, well, it's good for me, therefore it's got to be good for everybody else, doesn't necessarily pan out from an operational standpoint, obviously, and that's what's really driving a lot of the discontent around this issue. And coming up next, Mike Dettillier, one of my favorite NFL analysts, to talk about last night's nail-biter game. The fingers are still hurting. The 9 penalties that they said they had seemed like 90. I don't know how many yards we lost as a result of those penalties, but it was a lot. So stay with us. We'll be with Mike Dettillier when we come back.